It's Ideasphere with educator John Kuhn, Fear and Learning.
There's the concept that my tax dollars from my community should stay here and they should benefit the kids here. The answer, in my opinion, is to avoid that conversation and that fight over local tax dollars by funding education through some other means of taxation, either a statewide property tax or a state sales tax or a state income tax, but something so that people don't feel entitled to greater investment in their children than their neighbors receive.
The rising tide of mediocrity is a phrase we're familiar with. It cropped up in the 1980s to characterize the state of public education in America. To translate, it means our students are lacking basic skills and are below the level of students from other advanced nations. The cause and remedy are open for debate. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with educator and author John Kuhn. Several years ago, Kuhn penned a plea for help in what is now known as the Alamo Letter, in which he goes directly to the heart of the problem, inequality. More alarming than declining test scores, he contends, is the defunding of our public schools. Kuhn is the superintendent of the Perrin Witt Consolidated Independent School District in Texas and a vocal advocate for public education. His recent book is Fear and Learning in America: Bad Data, Good Teachers, and the Attack on Public Education. And he joins me for this program. Thanks for taking this time, Mr. Kuhn.
Thanks for having me.
This is going to be a book that's obviously going to shake up some folks because not many are willing to discuss this in the terms you have. In reality, one reading the book is going to realize afterwards, if they're not aware of it beforehand, the way we fund our school system is counterintuitive in many ways.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. One of the things that struck me as I, worked through my career as a public educator was the discovery that in Texas, at least, and certainly in many states, we fund our local public schools differently depending on the property values in that area. The word counterintuitive is absolutely correct, and I would add to that the word counterproductive. The unfortunate result of this way of funding public schools is that we send fewer resources to schools where students generally come from poverty in greater numbers. Property value levels in neighborhoods where there's a greater concentration of poverty are lower, and therefore the tax rate, when it's applied, generates less funding. In the state of Texas, there are school districts that can tax at half the tax rate and generate double the funding. What troubles me most about this entire enterprise is the fact that A, the states are not forthright and honest about this reality, and then B, the school accountability provisions that we've enacted into law completely ignore the funding reality. They decontextualize school performance so that even if you get 50% of a neighboring school, you're required to have your students score at the same levels on standardized tests, which to me is an unjust thing to ask.
This is an interesting aspect of what you're writing about, and I think readers would appreciate knowing this part of it. You were at one point a minister and conservative, but in following the conservative talk show hosts, you were shocked when you saw that at one point you witnessed an attack on teaching that was totally unwarranted.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of my past, I think. I grew up kind of a product of my environment, very active member of a Southern Baptist church, and actually spent 2 years as a missions volunteer in Peru, which was a great experience. I met my wife there, and we're happily married today. Came back from Peru and went into public education and was proud to do it. I felt patriotic about being a teacher. I felt I was serving my community, serving my state. And I had been, as a young man, frequent listener to conservative radio shows and contemporary Christian radio here in Texas, which is still very popular. And along the way, actually it was in 2006, I had just moved out of the classroom and into the assistant principal role at a rural school here in Texas, watched a program on television, and it was 2020, was the news magazine, but they had a segment called Stupid in America. And it was a fairly brutal takedown of public education and teachers. And it jarred me And what really jarred me about it was that the host of this program was a conservative or libertarian news journalist. And I had always agreed with him and listened to these programs that he had done about different things. And I had certain conservative beliefs about welfare and things like that. And with this one program where I noticed that it was not objective, it was a very one-sided portrayal of teachers wherein he showed really bad examples of bad teachers and bad public schools and neglected to show the other side, that there were public schools that were working very effectively. And it struck me personally because I had worked in public schools where I felt like my colleagues were doing a wonderful job, doing a great job. And it opened my eyes to this reality that just because something is put out there on the news or on the radio, if it's one-sided and it hides half the story, you can easily be misled. And so in seeing what I thought was a misleading program about my people, teachers, I realized that some of the programs I had listened to before about issues like welfare and things like that, that those had also been misleading. And it hadn't struck me because I didn't identify with the targets of the kind of pseudo-journalism, you know? And so from that point forward, I think I became a much more critical listener and viewer of media, and I've remained that way. And so a lot of the rhetoric around public education today, I'm very critical as I listen to it, but not only that, a lot of political coverage that I see, I'm a lot more critical than I used to be as I listen to it. And I don't just take things at face value like I probably did when I was a college commuter listening to Rush Limbaugh.
The other aspect of this in relation to what you've learned is that media are generally going to pick up the talking points of the politicians and deliver that as though it's factual, whereas, an example, standardized testing, which media use on a regular basis, is an example of what works in America today. And yet you know for a fact that there needs to be some changes made. That voice is not being heard.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I think really there's a real disadvantage to those of us that are proponents of public education, because most teachers and most administrators are really not in a position where they feel that they can be very vocal or very politically engaged. One of the things I talk about in the book early on is just kind of the danger of staking out a political position as a school official, because we represent our communities and our communities are diverse. Not everyone agrees. And what we're tasked with in educating the children is creating a team approach to educate all the children and work with all the parents from all the different backgrounds. So it's scary to speak out on behalf of public education when you work in public education. And, you know, there's a little voice in my head, even today after I've written a book about it, that says, you know, maybe I shouldn't be giving radio interviews and espousing my political views on the value of public education, because I know that there are people who disagree and pretty vehemently disagree. And I don't really want to, you know, create angst or enemies or anything like that. At the same time, there's another voice in my head saying, if nobody speaks up in defense of these public educators who are toiling there's 3 million of them in the United States, 3 million teachers in the United States. If no one ever speaks up for them, then what happens? Somebody's got to speak up for them. So that's why I wrote the book, I guess.
And the book is Fear and Learning in America, Bad Data, Good Teachers, and the Attack on Public Education, authored by John Kuhn, with a foreword by Diane Ravitch. Fear and Learning in America. You have a website, blog, tweet, anything else you'd recommend?
I would recommend people follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at John Kuhn TX. The TX is for Texas. And that's JohnKuhnTX, no spaces.
Okay. Once again, looking at Ravitch's introduction, going back to what you said just a moment ago, you needed to speak up. Well, she's in total agreement with that. Pleased that you did. She writes a tremendous review in assessing your work here, which has not gotten a lot of attention, not just your work, but the idea of reassessing education in America.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a conventional wisdom that is carrying the day right now that is in contrast to what I write about. And, you know, the simple narrative of the conventional wisdom is that American public schools are failing and that the problem is the teachers and that we need school choice to give people an opportunity to get away from that. The reality is that that's a very simplistic notion, and that there's all sorts of data that contradict those points. So there's a conversation that needs to be had, and it needs to be two-sided. It needs to include voices like Diane Ravitch, who, by the way, was an assistant U.S. Secretary of Education, and who at one time was a proponent of some of these kind of test and punish style education reforms, but who then at some point came to the conclusion that these policies were not working and were counterproductive. And so she changed her tune as well, and she's written some very good books about this same subject. But I do agree that the voice of teachers and public school parents who are advocates for public schools, they don't really have access to the same microphones that a lot of the foundations and think tanks and politicians and political forces have access to. So I feel like in my case, in the case of allies and advocates across the United States, little small organizations of public education advocates, that we are the grassroots, and that we do contend with groups that are very well financed, oftentimes by some of the very richest people in America who want to refashion our public education system into a free market approach to education.
Interesting you would say that, because in reference to the free market, because as I was reading your work, somehow I got the idea that there were similarities in funding for education as there was in sports. So a team in Los Angeles or San Francisco is going to have a lot more money for purchasing the World Series or the Super Bowl than a team that's sitting in a smaller city of, let's say, Toronto, to grab one. However, that is free enterprise. It's the economic system. You could look at it and say, here is capitalism in action. That should not be translated into education. And yet, if you look at it, it is. And one of the points in your book that I had to laugh at when I came across was Nate Silver's work in using the algorithms to test politicians and education.
I think, first of all, the analogy you just made to a sports team is fantastic. I've never thought about it in that way, but that's exactly what it is. There are public school districts that, based on the resources they have available to them, they're almost guaranteed to have very high success rates on the standardized tests that their students take. And really, it's more than just the resources. It's also the student body and the social status and the financial status of that student body. What we've done in the United States, most states, I think one state that has done a better job of this that I've read about is Oregon. They've worked very hard to try and equalize school funding so that poorer areas have extra resources to try and help mitigate some of the consequences of children growing up in poverty. But most states do a really poor job of that, and my state does an extremely poor job of that. So what it amounts to is that not only will your school have more resources, but your school will also have a student body that is, generally speaking, coming to you already more prepared. Abraham Maslow came up with a list of human needs, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's called. And learning would be one of the things kind of at the top of that hierarchy. But before you can self-actualize, before you can pursue, you know, really personalized learning, your basic needs have to be met first, and that is food, shelter, a sense of security and love. And I think our education policy environment tries to ignore those basic needs and just jump right into academic rigor and doesn't provide the kind of resources needed to meet those other human needs.
The comments that were made by the education secretary in Texas, this is your state, your career was based in Texas, so you know that system very well. It's not all that different, but to some degree it is, than the rest of the country. But interesting statement on his retirement coming from Robert Scott out of the Education Department.
Yeah, you know, Robert Scott kind of shocked a lot of us school administrators in Texas toward the end of his tenure. He had been involved in a lot of the school reforms in Texas that centralized and elevated standardized testing and the labeling of schools and the labeling of teachers and a lot of the things that I'm pretty skeptical of in my book. And so he had been kind of a party to that. But at the end of his tenure, he appeared before the State Board of Education And at this time, standardized testing in Texas had just really taken off. The contract with the test contractor, which is Pearson, was almost $500 million for 5 years worth of tests. And so testing had become this huge thing. And as he was addressing the State Board of Education, Robert Scott actually used the term military-industrial complex to describe the testing contractor and its lobbying forces that it had. And he even said that, you know, testing is a perversion of what learning is supposed to be. And he basically said, we've messed up. We've messed up. And he said, testing is the heart of the vampire. And what he really meant was, and he reiterated these points about a week later in an address to school superintendents that gathered from around the state of Texas for their annual conference. He basically said, you know, we've messed up by overemphasizing testing, and now testing has taken on a life of its own. And he actually used the phrase, it's the be-all, end-all of schooling now, and that's not what it's supposed to be. I think in school reform, an interesting thing I've noted is that there are approaches that we come up with and we put them out there, and then they tend to get hijacked. And so something that may have been a decent idea at the outset gets twisted into something that's harmful. And I think standardized testing is like that. I think, you know, the initial idea was, let's have a statewide test and have all our kids take it and we'll see how they're doing. And then, you know, if kids are struggling in a school, maybe we can help them out, give them additional resources or what have you. What happened was that notion got hijacked on a couple of levels. Number one, the testing contractor, every 3 or 4 years, we were getting a new test, which was more expensive and more tests were given, more time was eating up in the classroom to give these tests. But then on the other end, too, there were those who, for ideological reasons, just kind of opposed public education to begin with. So they began to see usefulness in these test scores and these comparing the data. So instead of using the data to say, hey, maybe we need more resources in these under-resourced urban schools and border schools and rural schools where property values are low, instead of rushing to them with financial help to hire teachers and whatnot, instead, we're going to punish them. You know, we're just going to kind of blow things up. And so what could have been a beneficial thing has turned into an act of statewide vandalism.
Talking with John Kuhn, superintendent of the Perrin Witt Consolidated Independent School District in Texas, author of Fear and Learning in America. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back. Back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, author and educator John Kuhn, Fear and Learning in America. Something we need to discuss is what this can mean to teachers, how this could be pushing back on them. The test scores are not effective, but if the school does not rate higher from those test scores, there is the issue of whether or not the teacher's failing. And in many cases, as you have witnessed, that's not the issue at all.
Yeah, I think it's far more simple than that. And unfortunately, a lot of our politicians in both parties have kind of accepted uncritically this notion that bad test scores mean bad teaching is going on. There are a lot of things that impact test scores. A lot of those things have nothing to do with the teacher. I've mentioned in this program today, school funding differences. Well, that's the politician's fault. You know, if they don't have the courage to direct funding to where it's needed, and they want to take the path of least resistance, how can teachers be held to account for trying to get the same results with less resources? It's exactly what we do. Another thing that is hard to account for is the difference in student populations that teachers receive depending on where they're at. So there's an unfortunate consequence of this, which, by the way, is now being enforced from the federal level. The U.S. Department of Education is requiring states to evaluate teachers based on the standardized test scores of their students. That's going to have a few effects that I think are counterproductive. One is it's going to make standardized testing even more the focus of what we do in schools. And in my opinion, there's a lot more to what education is supposed to be than just getting math and English discrete facts drilled into kids' heads. There's so much more to it than that. But since that's what's on the test, that's what drives things. But the other thing evaluating teachers based on student test scores does is it dissuades teachers from going to work in the toughest schools where the needs are the greatest. Again, you mentioned counterproductive early on in this conversation with the funding. We don't want to drive our best teachers away from our neediest schools. We want to drive them to those neediest schools. That's how we fix things.
What one is going to come away with your work is the personal aspect that you add to it. One is that the pain you feel when a student cannot pass the required exam, and you have that example very early in your book. And then later you have a personal story. The confrontation with a troubled student leads to an arrest.
That's from my experience. I think a lot of times when people weigh in on education, a lot of times we hear these suggestions and ideas and innovations that are supposed to fix everything. A lot of times the people that come out with those prescriptions don't have the experiences that teachers and students and parents who are living that public education experience have. And so many of the prescriptions that I've seen come along during my career have really missed the mark. They've been kind of clumsy attempts to fix things. And because of that, a lot of times they amount to little more than fads, and they're here today and they're gone tomorrow. So teachers are kind of constantly dealing with this. And so one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is express some of the nuance and the context of what schooling is. And I think that context is vital so that when we implement policies to try and guarantee a quality education, we have to acknowledge and honor the context of what's going on in the schools.
You're looking at the changes necessary in funding, and the property tax that is used for funding is where the distortion comes from at the moment, because in a more expensive community, the higher the taxes, the more that school receives money. And it affects the smaller communities or the less expensive communities in a very negative fashion. Do you feel that America then, Americans, are going to be able to accept that my tax dollar is going to be equal in its distribution to all schools?
I don't know politically if the people of the United States will accept that or not. I know that in the state of Texas, we have been battling over this idea for decades. In fact, we are currently in our seventh lawsuit dating all the way back to the 1960s. And these lawsuits going back and forth all along, they've been about how tax dollars are invested in educational services. And, you know, there's the concept that my tax dollars from my community should stay here and they should benefit the kids here. The answer, in my opinion, is to avoid that conversation and that fight over local tax dollars by funding education through some other means of taxation, either a statewide property tax or a state sales tax or a state income tax, but something so that people don't feel entitled to greater investment in their children than their neighbors receive. I think fundamentally that's a destructive policy to invest disparate amounts in different kids around the state. You know, I don't know next year if I'm going to live in where I live now or if I'm going to move to another town, but as a dad, I would like to know that wherever I go, the schools are equally supported. I compare it sometimes to the interstate highway system. We have an interstate highway system that as you drive across the state, you know, the road is, it's asphalt the whole way. It doesn't turn into a gravel road when you go through poorer areas. And the reason we have that is because we don't want to tear up our cars. Well, we shouldn't want to tear up our kids either. There should be a minimum guarantee in all the states of what any kid of any ethnicity, of any background, of any socioeconomic status, there should be a minimum guarantee in the states of what kind of education that child should get. And we're failing on that. We've made that promise in our constitutions, but we're failing to deliver it.
And what you see also is the lack of voice for the teachers and the students as the funds are being distributed in an unfair fashion.
Yeah, and you know, I think honestly, teachers don't even realize it. Until I became an administrator, I just assumed that wherever you went to school in Texas, you got X number of dollars to educate a kid, and that was just how it was. So teachers may not even realize that some of them are starting out behind the starting line because of funding inequity. Teachers that I work with and that I've worked with over my career, they have a pretty single-minded focus on their subject and their classroom and their kids. They go in and they teach their classes and they do their job. And, you know, a lot of times they're kind of blissfully unaware of the politics that surrounds all this. I know I was when I was a teacher, but now that I've become an administrator and started looking at budgets and started paying attention to the inequity, it's very frustrating to be held to the same accountability standards as every other school in the state, knowing that there are schools that are disadvantaged by the funding.
Something that is going to have to happen if we're going to have a dialogue is for the media to step up to the issue and start discussing all sides of this. The problem is you don't hear what we're talking about right now. You just don't hear it. Is there another approach you see that might be more beneficial?
You know, I'm not sure how to force the conversation and how to get the media to listen to the side of public school teachers and parents. I think what I've seen happen in Texas recently, in 2013, we had a group of moms. They formed an organization called Texans Advocating for Meaningful Student Assessment. And they were extremely active in recruiting parents from all over the state. And they were extremely assertive with our state legislators. And they actually were extremely successful. At the end of the legislative session where they were so vocal, the legislature restored some of the $5.4 billion of education funding that it had cut the previous session. And the legislature reduced the emphasis on standardized tests. The previous session, they had required 15 standardized tests for a student to graduate. The student had to pass 15 tests. After this group of advocate moms got finished with the legislature, they changed it to 5 tests. And these moms are promising to be active again next session. I think we see in New York a very vibrant movement of parents opposing some of the test and punish policies in that state. I read this morning that there were 66,000 students whose parents refused to let them take the most recent standardized test. So, you know, in my opinion, it's somewhat sad that some people feel like they have to resort to civil disobedience to have their voices heard. But like you noted, the conversation seems very one-sided, and there's a lot of money and power behind certain aspects of the education reform movement, and there's not a whole lot behind the public school parents who have concerns about overtesting. You know, they're just kind of grassroots.
Mr. Kuhn, thank you so very much. It's been a pleasure with reading your material, and I think you have some issues here that I hope others will address.
Well, I thank you so much for the time today. I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Fear and Learning in America, John Kuhn. You can reach him at Twitter, John Kuhn TX. That's JohnKuhnTX. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.